This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 90-year-old Jim Roach of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Ogden, Utah. He spent 30 years in the U.S. Air Force, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. We've heard about his World War II experiences as a young B-24 pilot with the 485th Bomb Group, the 830th Squadron, flying out of Italy. After the war, he earned a degree from Utah State University before returning to the military. During the Korean War, he served in Germany. He spent some time as a finance officer in California. Then, after learning to fly jet aircraft, he was sent back to Germany. And from 1965 to 68, in that part of Europe, he was part of what he referred to earlier as a spook squadron. The backdrop, of course, the Cold War and the unrelenting tension between the capitalist West and the communist and socialist East. There's a war dragging on in Vietnam, but there's also the underlying threat of nuclear war. So what were you flying in this spook squadron, and what were you doing over there?
Flying C-97s.
That's a big refueling plane, but was repurposed for what you were doing.
Yes, it had different configurations. Now, two of them had 11 electronic warfare officer positions, the consoles.
Mm-hmm.
And they're searching for signals.
So you have all these guys on your plane that from the outside, if the Germans are looking at it, they think it's to refuel bombers, right?
No, because there was no boom.
You didn't have the boom for refueling.
No.
But that was the profile of this giant plane.
Yeah.
But inside you have all these consoles. So basically you guys are flying around trying to pick up radio frequencies to find out what the socialists are doing.
Yes. We flew airplanes to Berlin every day.
Mm-hmm.
They called us the Berlin Lunch Bunch. And then we would go down to Athens, Greece, and fly missions around the Mediterranean, hoping to pick up something from a Russian fishing boat or whatever we could find down there. And then we had this one airplane, an aircraft number 106, I'll never forget it. And Dave Brog was the project officer on that aircraft, working directly with the CIA. What they were after was the Fansong radar. We would go to Berlin at the same time almost every day, usually in a squadron. The squadron commander doesn't really do much with the flying end of it. He's busy with other stuff. The operations officer runs the show.
Right.
Well, I was the operations officer. I was running the show.
So you're running the show and you're flying as part of this squadron.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So Dave Brog came to me one day and he said, you know, we know that the Fansong is up there, but it's always on standby when we go up there and we can't get the frequency. He says, why don't we vary the takeoff time? I said, how about 6 o'clock in the morning? We'll be up there at 6:30. It's only about a half hour flight from Frankfurt area, Wiesbaden. And he said, sure. I said, I'll fly the airplane. I told Brog that. So we went up there and he got the Fansong radar. That was a big, big, big achievement.
Right. And I want to make sure everybody understands this, put it in perspective. They heard you mention a minute ago the CIA. What you guys were doing, this was secret stuff.
Oh, it was. Very secret.
Not only were the enemy wasn't supposed to know about it, but people in America didn't know that this kind of work was going on.
Well, I think everybody over there had a pretty good idea. You know, the people around Wiesbaden and at the air base. They knew we were up to something because it was all so clandestine.
Yeah.
All very quiet.
And when you talk about this Fansong, I'm sure a lot of people are saying, okay, what's he talking about here? What was the significance of this discovery that you guys made?
Because it controlled the SAMs. The Fansong radar is what controls the citrus to air missiles. With that frequency, with the proper jamming equipment, they could jam that and divert the SAM from its intended target. And it was really a big achievement.
Right. So if these surface-to-air missiles were launched, there was the chance to intercept them or divert them so they wouldn't hit the target. And you're talking about saving lots of lives.
And Vietnam. Saved a lot of fighter pilots, but really, really a lot of them.
And a lot of people, maybe their minds are blown a little bit to say, well, you're in Germany, but you're affecting Vietnam. But that's really what it was, because you finally found this frequency that they had been able to hide.
Yes. Yes, that's very true.
And it's probably really hard to quantify how big a difference that made, how many lives it might have saved.
It saved Dave Brog's career, I'll tell you that. He was a passed-over captain, and he progressed very rapidly after that.
And I guess the other question that comes to mind with that duty, which, you know, there's the intrigue of it being secret, there's what had to be an exhilarating feeling to finally find what you'd been looking for this whole time. But were those dangerous missions? Was there some danger in flying that route?
If you flew into East Germany, you could be shot down. And we had, prior to my arrival, we did lose two aircraft. Mm-hmm. They got off course over Eastern Germany. Both of them were shot down.
Well, how close do you think you came to East German airspace?
Well, we would fly the quarters. We had three quarters into Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't fly above 10,000 feet, and the corridor were 20 nautical miles wide, so we had to stay within that corridor.
But you probably came within a mile or two of...
Oh, yes, and when we get up to the circle, then we could fly around in the circle, and that was very restricted as well. We were very careful. We used to take the off. We had a couple of our 97s had the entire side of the aircraft opened hydraulically. We had a camera with a 100-inch lens, if you can imagine that.
100-inch
lens.
That's 8 feet long.
It's big.
So it would protrude out of the aircraft when you lower that side?
No, it was mounted.
Uh-huh.
Inside the aircraft. So we'd go up to the northern end of Germany and fly all the way down to Czechoslovakia, down around, and then at 25,000 feet, then take pictures as far as inland as 70 miles with those cameras. Just probably pick up whatever's going on with the Russians, what they're doing on there, you know. So that was a very rewarding mission.
You guys were able to take photos that had strategic value.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So you're doing stuff in Europe that's affecting the war in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia. And I guess that wasn't good enough for you because you ended up going to Vietnam and flying a different plane over there.
Well, all Air Force pilots, I think, were expected to put in a tour in Vietnam. I didn't want to come back to the States and have Vietnam in front of me. I wanted to go from Germany to Vietnam and then get that over with. So I volunteered to go to Vietnam.
So this is kind of like when you were in Albuquerque and they give you the out. They say, hey, you can stay here in World War II and train these bombardiers. You didn't know how long the war in Vietnam was going to go. You
No.
could have come home and maybe you wouldn't have had to go to Vietnam.
That's true. But to give you an example of what happened, a very good friend of ours, he was in Germany at the same time. I was not in our squadron. He was at Ramstein. He came back to the States and was signed up at McChord Air Force Base in Washington. Well, I went to Vietnam and came back to the station in McChord and we became friends. Well, he eventually got tapped to go to Vietnam, and oh, he was so bent out of shape. He just thought that he shouldn't have to go to Vietnam. And I told him, I said, well, Bob, why don't you volunteer for when you rotated out of Germany and get it over with at that time?
Yeah, gave you a taste of what might have been had you not made that choice, I guess.
Yeah.
But the duty that you had in Vietnam, the missions that you were flying, again, were very dangerous.
Not really. We were.
You finally made Pat laugh. She's scoffing at that answer.
Well, there's danger in all operations, in all combat operations.
Well, and tell everybody about the plane that you flew there and what those missions were.
Well, we flew AC-119s. It had four Gatling guns firing out the side. I had a gun sight over my left shoulder. Now, if I could acquire the target manually, then I could take care of the target myself.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's something I couldn't acquire visually from my position, we had a night optical sight. The guy was standing in the door, of course, with webbing so he wouldn't fall out. He had this magnified light 12 times, and he would pick up stuff on the ground. Then he would feed that to me through the computer into my gun sight, and then we would fire on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very effective, very, very effective.
So you were flying at night quite a bit?
All of them.
All night
missions.
At what altitude?
3,000 foot was the firing altitude. It would be 3,000 feet above the ground.
And what are you firing at?
Mostly what they call ticks, troops in contact. They loved us because we did very, very good work.
So what you're doing with this plane and all these guns on the side is you make a pass and you fire away, you're pushing back the enemy and creating some space for your ground troops?
What we did was mostly we defended Special Forces camps. I was the outhouse over there, so I could pick when I wanted to fly. And I always picked the first mission, Shadow 6-1. That was the first one off at night. There was a Special Forces camp over near the Laotian border that they knew that they were going to be under attack because the NVA was in the area. Not the Kong, but the NVA themselves, the regular army.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted the coverage right immediately upon arrival darkness. So I took off in daylight, got over there, and we worked the target and refueled and kept working it. I made my first takeoff in daylight and my last landing in daylight. Flew around the clock.
Wow.
And the next day...
You just told me these weren't dangerous missions.
Well...
And don't you think the enemy would have liked to shoot you down so you couldn't protect that?
That thought entered their mind.
And it's not like you're that far up there. I mean, you're pretty close to 3,000 those guns.
3,000 feet.
There's plenty of guns they had that had the range to knock you out.
They did. So anyway, the next day after this mission, 12-hour mission,
Yeah.
Our intelligence officer says, hey, Colonel Roach, were you flying Shadow 6-1 last night? And I said, yeah. He says, you got 200 BDA. And I said, well, put it on the board. They kept track of how many enemy you're knocking off, you know. And so I got credit for 200 BDA, whatever that's worth.
And tell everybody what BDA stands for.
Battle Damage Assessment. But it was bodies.
And I know that's there's part of that, maybe, that even after all those years in the Air Force, that weighs on you, that that's a human cost. But how many lives do you think you saved?
It should weigh on me, but you justify it by how many of the good guys did we save. I had it one night where the camp was under attack. Our requirements were we weren't to fire within 200 meters of the perimeter. So this guy was on the ground screaming at me, bring it in closer, bring it in closer. I said, I can't bring it in closer. We're firing right at the edge now. And he said, they're on the wire. We're all undercover. Spray the whole camp down. So I did. I put two on the line. Went into. We used to fly around in a circle.
Right.
And I put two on the line and hosed them down and saved their butts.
Wow. That had to be a little nerve-wracking.
Well, I don't know. That was. You get used to things, you know.
I guess.
You get used to stuff.
But basically what you're saying is the whole reason for this 200-meter buffer is that you don't have any incidents of friendly fire casualties.
Yeah, that's what you didn't want to have.
And basically they're telling you, we don't care. This we're going to be dead if you don't do it.
Well, we're all undercover. That's how he said it. He said,
yeah.
He said that they're on the wire. We're all undercover. Hose the camp down. So I put two on the line, half rate. So each gun would fire 100 rounds a second.
Woo.
6,000 rounds a minute. Of course, you couldn't do that. You'd run out of ammunition, no time at all. When I was firing at a target, I'd always ask the gunners to put me on two at half rate. Two guns, half rate, 3,000 rounds a minute. And then control your bursts, you know, make very short bursts.
Yeah.
We'd take off with 50,000 rounds of ammunition, but that'd go in a hurry if you weren't judicious in your use of it.
And people look at that 119, and they're not going to say, oh, that looks like a fighter plane, but kind of what you were doing is what a fighter pilot would have done in World War II on, you know, say a P-47 or a P-51 would have been strafing the enemy. You're basically flying a circle around this position, strafing the enemy to hold them off and save these Americans' lives.
That's true. That's what happened. That's how it was.
That sounds nerve-wracking enough to me. I don't know how it didn't get to you.
Well,
you're just wired that way?
I don't know. All I can say is you get used to things.
You know, so many World War II vets that I've interviewed, we'll talk about the empathy they have for the Vietnam era veteran and how differently he was received coming back to the States compared to the World War II generation. Here you had some very intense experiences in both conflicts. How did you feel about Vietnam and the way it ended up?
I didn't like it. When we had 500,000 troops over there, 500,000 troops over there, we had no business being over there, in my view. It should never have been. But that's beside the point. For my personal aspect, or my personal involvement, I should say, I was a regular Air Force officer, and that was my assignment, and that's what I tried. I took the assignment, I did the best I could at it, and hoped for the best, you know.
And I guess the other big difference between World War II and Vietnam, in World War II, you weren't married yet, you didn't have a daughter, but in Vietnam, you had a wife and a daughter that you needed to make sure you came home to, huh?
Oh, boy, did I ever hope so. And we met in Hawaii. It was a very tender moment.
Did you ever have any moments where you weren't sure that was going to happen?
I always thought it could, and I prayed a lot. But no, it has to enter your mind, you know.
Sure. You know, before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country for all those years.
Oh.
And thank you for telling us about it, because it helps us understand what a great price has been paid for our freedom. I do wonder if there's anything that you wanted to do in the Air Force that you never got to do.
I would like to have been promoted to full colonel, and that didn't happen. And I pretty much had a good time in the Air Force. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
I've been sitting here with you and listening to you talk, and I see what good shape you're in at almost 91 years old, and I'm just wondering. There's still a few B-24s flying around today.
No, there's not. Only one.
Well, the one that's flying, if you were taking a ride in it and all of a sudden they needed you to hop in that left seat and bring it in for a landing.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah?
I could do it. When my 80th birthday, our daughter was living in L.A. and working in L.A. at the time. She said, well, I want you to come down for your birthday. So we did. We went to line. We drove down there, and she said, okay, we're going to get up early tomorrow. And I said, what's all about? She said, well, I'll tell you in the morning. So we went out to Burbank Airport. You're going to go for a ride in a B-24. And she spoke to the crew and asked them if I could sit up front because I had flown B-24. And they allowed me to do that.
Uh-huh.
But had the need arisen, I'd dump that left seat and put it on the ground for him. I feel sure I could have done it.
Even on the island of Vis?
Well, I could, no, not on the island of Vis. I need a little bit more runway than that.
I think a lot of people listening are like me, and we aspire to have a marriage that lasts 66 years like yours has. What's your secret? Did you just pick a good one? Or
Keep.
Oh, you're motioning to keep your lips zipped?
Keep quiet. do a lot of listening and not much talking.
Uh-huh.
Not only is she a wonderful wife, she's a wonderful person. She has a heart as big as this house. And she's very, very sweet. I tell her every day how much I love her. I keep telling her, don't leave home without me, because I don't want her to go first.
Well, and something comes to mind, and I've interviewed a lot of veterans who maybe got married before World War II and came home and met children for the first time that were 2-3 years old. And that always seems hard, and I can't imagine myself in that situation. But I'm thinking about your military career and flying for 30 years and a lot of those dangerous missions overseas. I bet you've given some thought over the years to what it took for your wife to deal with that reality of having a husband who she knew was in danger for that long.
Well, I think she worried about me in Vietnam a lot. And our daughter worried herself sick about it. She was quite young then, of course. So it bothered her a lot, and it bothered Pat a lot. But we prayed for the best, and it turned out well. And she's still with me.
She sure is. And you can see photos of Jim and Pat then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time on today's program, but I want to thank another pilot, Greg Shoppy, for letting me know about his great uncle Jim and making it possible to share this Distinguished Flying Cross recipient story with you today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.